We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. According to estimates from the United Nations, at any given time around the world, there are something like 12 million, at least 12 million adults and children in forced labor and commercial sexual servitude. In many countries, there are laws against trafficking, but some cases those laws are so weak, criminals find it actually safer to trade in human beings than to trade in things like guns or drugs. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Carol Peterson. She is professor of law at the University of Hawaii. And she is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, and we'll give a talk tomorrow. This is the annual Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture. It's a lecture that has been going on now for a long time. This is the 19th, and it was named for Dan Sanders, who was at one time the dean of the School of Social Work here at the University of Illinois. And our guest will be talking on the topic Trafficking in Women, Legal Debates, and Social Realities. And she will be giving her talk tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center on South Lincoln Avenue in Urbana. This program is free and open to anybody who would like to attend. So if you're interested, you should feel welcome to stop by. And this morning in this hour, we're here live and we're taking calls and emails. And so if you're interested in being a part of the conversation, you're welcome to do that as well. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number. We also have toll-free line, meaning and that means that if it would be long-distance call for you, use that number. We'll pay for the call. You may also email your comments and questions to will-talk. That's just as it sounds, will-talk@illinois.edu. Just a little bit more about our guest, Carol Peterson. She is Associate Professor of Law and also Director of the Spark Matsunaga Institute for Peace at University of Hawaii in Manoa. She practiced law for 5 years in New York and also in Honolulu, and from there went to Hong Kong and taught in Hong Kong at university there. She was also Director of the University of Hong Kong Center for Comparative and Public Law. Her main interests of research include international human rights, women in the law, and migration and human rights. And we're pleased that she could be with us here this morning. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. It's lovely to be here.
The numbers that I quoted, these come from the International Labor Organization, which is a UN agency, and that's where I get this number for human trafficking. They say at least 12.3 million adults and children. And then if you just look at people who are trafficked for sexual purposes, you're getting close to 1.4 million, and overall, apparently more than half of all forced labor victims are women.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that the suspicion is that these numbers are probably too low. They're probably all bigger than that?
Well, that's a very good question. The truth is, I view virtually every estimate of the number of victims of trafficking with a little bit of skepticism, because it's honestly such a difficult area to study. And it is by its nature a fairly subterranean economy. And so when organizations like the ILO try to put these estimates together, they rely on two sources primarily, reports from government and also reports from non-governmental organizations working in the field. There is no universally accepted method of counting the victims of trafficking. And there's often quite a bit of debate about whether a person is a victim of trafficking or simply an undocumented migrant. And that's one of the things I'll be talking about tomorrow night. I don't think it's always so easy to separate, right? So when you look at these estimates, you have to realize they are estimates. Sometimes governments have a natural incentive to underestimate the victims of trafficking in their country, because no government wants to be designated as an origin or a transit point or a destination of trafficking. So very often governments will have an interest in underestimating how many people who they arrest for migration offenses are actually victims of trafficking. On the other hand, it's also been alleged that many non-governmental organizations exaggerate the number of victims of trafficking, mm-hmm. because they have an interest in trying to obtain more funds for services for victims of trafficking, and they tend very often to have a little broader definition of who is a victim of trafficking than governments sometimes have. So when an organization like the ILO puts together these estimates, they realize that they're trying to get a ballpark estimate. I think it's probably correct that there, in my definition of trafficking, there are probably more than the ILO estimates. But not all governments would necessarily agree with my definition.
Yeah. There is an there have been a number of international agreements on trafficking. You can correct me as I'm not exactly sure what the correct terminology for these agreements would be. But in any case, the most recent one is the Victims of Trafficking and Violence Protection Act of 2000.
That's U.S. legislation.
All right.
Right. There is also an international protocol, a protocol to the International Convention on Crime called the Trafficking Protocol, right. which was adopted in 2000.
And is it clear, do these things make an attempt to define what trafficking is or what a trafficked person would be?
Yes, they do. The Trafficking Protocol has a definition of trafficking of persons. And from that, you can extrapolate the definition of a victim of trafficking. It is somewhat vague, however, because it provides that a person can be a victim of trafficking if they were subjected to deception, force, coercion, or exploitation of a position of vulnerability. I'm summarizing it a little bit. But the Trafficking Protocol is somewhat vague on just how bad the person's vulnerability must have been before that can become a condition of that makes them a victim of trafficking. And you see, it makes a huge difference because the Trafficking Protocol, which is a treaty, obligates state parties to not only try to prevent trafficking with immigration controls and criminal law enforcement, but it also expects them to provide assistance to victims. Mm-hmm. The victim assistance provisions are more suggestions than mandatory requirements, and many people were disappointed with that when the Trafficking Protocol was drafted. But there is a heavy pressure on state parties to provide assistance to victims of trafficking, to not prosecute them as illegal migrants, and rather to give them counseling, social services, and maybe even allow them to stay in the country as legal migrants. Because they are victims of trafficking. So for that reason, many governments will have a natural incentive to adopt a fairly narrow definition of trafficking when they apply that definition in their national laws and national policies. Now, the legislation that you mentioned is a United States federal law, which defines trafficking in slightly different language than the protocol, but similar. And it does provide that victims of trafficking can be eligible for what we call the T visa, the trafficking visa. And we have given a certain number of these visas out. But even when you compare the number of visas in the United States that have been issued with the estimates of the number of people who are trafficked into the U.S., it's clear it's a fairly small percentage. I've seen estimates of anywhere from 40 to 50,000 individuals being trafficked into the United States each year. Again, those estimates are speculative. But it's far smaller number of T visas that are actually issued. And people have to meet with certain requirements. They've usually got to be willing to assist with prosecution of the traffickers, for example. Not everyone is willing to do that. Some people are very nervous about what might happen to them or to their families in their home countries if they assist with prosecution. And the other thing about the victim assistance programs is that although we have this idea that there's this huge gap between an illegal migrant and a victim of trafficking, the truth is that most research shows that a lot of people are in the gray area. They're in the middle, right? Mm-hmm. So someone might have started out as a willing migrant, might have even been aware that they were going to break some laws in the course of their migration. But at a certain point in time, they become an unwilling victim of trafficking. And every legal system has its own way of dealing with those people. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that it's not always so easy to say whether someone is this virtuous victim of trafficking or has broken some laws and might actually be an illegal migrant. Very often people have elements of both in their personal histories.
Well, I think this is an important point, and perhaps it does show how it is that this can be difficult, particularly if in law you're trying to be very specific about what you're talking about, that you could make a clear and hypothetical sort of case about an individual who was abducted, taken from point A to point B across, say, an international line. That's one thing. But most of the time, I think either what you're talking about is people who were promised some sort of work, some sort of opportunity. Someone's come along and said, you know, we have really good jobs for people in this other country. So we'll take you there. We'll take care. We'll make all the arrangements. We'll see that you get this great job when you get there. And then when they do, they find out the situation is really very different, and they end up in some place where maybe they don't have papers, they don't have any money, where they become victims because they essentially have no choice. And then there's also that person, I'm sure, that is in country A, looks in country B, and thinks, well, you know, maybe my life will be better. Maybe here there's here good opportunities. These are people who are economic migrants, mm-hmm. who may indeed be illegal, but who actually willingly cross the line, and then because they get there and they don't have a job, they're not there legally, they maybe don't have any money, they end up being victimized because they're really defenseless.
Correct.
So we have one really clear case, but that's the hypothetical, and it probably very seldom happens. It's probably mostly the other kinds of things that we're talking about.
There is another group that I would put in the very clear case, and that's minors. People who are under the age of majority. And I think that's where just about every country agrees or should agree. If someone is abducted, which I agree with you is rare, or if someone is lured into a trafficking situation when they're under the age of majority, I think those people should be considered clear cases of trafficking. Because, I mean, in our research in Hong Kong, we interviewed women who were incarcerated in prison in Hong Kong. They were from mainland China. They had all been incarcerated, convicted for offenses relating to sex work. Sometimes there were immigration offenses. Sometimes it was simply working without a visa. Because sex work itself is not illegal in Hong Kong, but it is illegal if you're a migrant because you don't have a work visa. And a number of these women had come to Hong Kong knowing they were going to do sex work, and we did not classify them as victims of trafficking. Some of them had even arranged their own visas and travel arrangements, so you couldn't say they were victims of trafficking. But out of 75 women, we found 12 who were in prison serving time, who we thought should have been identified by the authorities as victims of trafficking. One of them was only 15 years old. And in my opinion, there was just no question. I mean, she was convicted of an immigration offense and sentenced, and no one bothered to really pursue the fact that she was under the age of consent for sexual intercourse in Hong Kong. So it was clear that she must have been a victim of trafficking. So I would put those people in a very clear case. But I agree with you, the majority of people are more in the gray area. Most of them have had their travel facilitated in some way or another by a third party. Either the visa was provided or the transportation was provided or the job placement was provided. And very often the trafficker deliberately puts the person in a situation of vulnerability. I mean, one of the things we found was fascinating in Hong Kong is although it's relatively easy for a person from mainland China now to get a tourist visa to come to Hong Kong, a certain number in our study had actually been provided with a fake visa or had even been smuggled into Hong Kong by boat, which is totally unnecessary, really. Yet what that meant is that when the girls were taken to a brothel in Mong Kok, and some of them were quite surprised to find that they were expected to do sex work, they were really vulnerable. And the managers, if you will, the mama-sons and the bosses of the brothels could say to them, sure, you can go outside. You can leave. The police will arrest you, and you will be put in prison because you are totally undocumented and you entered Hong Kong illegally. Or you made a false statement to an immigration officer when you showed that visa, which is someone else's name on it. So that, I think, is a pretty common tactic, is that people who are interested in gaining control of other people's labor want to put them in a position where they are afraid to go to the authorities. And if the authorities are not very discriminating when they interview these people, actually the traffickers are right, aren't they? I mean, we did find these people in jail. I mean, in Hong Kong, thousands of women from mainland China are put in jail every year, to the point where about half of the female prison population in Hong Kong is actually from mainland China. And that's because the Hong Kong government sends out police. They do raids on brothels. They arrest everyone who doesn't have a work visa. And they process them very quickly. We did court observations where these women were almost tried in groups. They're encouraged to plead guilty because it's very difficult for them to say they weren't intending to work in Hong Kong. They usually admit right out that they had intended to work. Many times they thought they were going to be working in some other industry, like dishwashing or foot massage. But they intended to work, and from the Hong Kong government's point of view, that's breach of condition of stay if you were only on a tourist visa. Mm-hmm. So you might as well plead guilty. You'll get a 3-month sentence. It'll be reduced to 2 months because you pled guilty, and you can be home in 2 months. So the trials go very, very quickly. And nobody really seems to be asking the women the questions that they should be asking if they really are looking for victims of trafficking.
And if you have a situation like that, you have a situation where this third party brings a woman into the country under false pretenses, maybe with false documents and so forth. And then they come down to it and they say, well, really what you're going to be doing here is you're going to be working in a brothel. The woman says, well, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to do that. And they say, okay, there's the door. But women know that, in fact, they can't really walk out.
Right. So, and sometimes they don't say there's the door. Sometimes they beat them up.
Essentially, you have a situation where a woman really has no choice.
Correct.
So she says, all right, she essentially agrees, although this is really clearly coercion. She essentially says, all right, fine. Would that enable a government to say, well, This woman is willing. She's agreed to do it. She's willingly said, "All right, I will do it." So that puts us in a whole different category.
Well, it depends on the domestic law. Under the trafficking protocol, the treaty I told you about, it should not change her status because the protocol clearly states that the presence of consent is irrelevant if it was preceded by deception, force, or coercion. So under the international agreement, it shouldn't make a difference. But not all countries implement that. Some of them have a different definition in law. Some of them have a definition that's similar, but they don't really apply it in practice. And some of them, like Hong Kong, they don't actually have any definition of trafficking victim in their domestic law. So it's really a matter of executive policy. And certainly the way I observed it from the interviews that we conducted in prison, I don't think the Hong Kong government would view that woman as a victim of trafficking. A number of the 12 women who we identified as victims of trafficking had eventually agreed under pressure to engage in sex work. Some of them told us it was simply because they hadn't been fed in a couple of days, or they had been locked up, or they had been told you can't go home until you pay off your visa fee and your transportation costs, and then we'll take you home. So they did it as a matter of pragmatism. A few women told us that they really resisted, and one of them told us that she was in a locked room, a room that was locked from the outside when the police raided the brothel. The police had to take the lock off from the outside to get in, but they still did not ask her if she was a victim of trafficking. They simply prosecuted her, and there she was sitting in prison. So it seems to me that the police are often turning a blind eye, and I think it's partly because they're just overwhelmed by the numbers. They have a lot of people to arrest. They're under a lot of pressure right now in Hong Kong to clean up the streets, if you will, and try to deter illegal migrants from coming into Hong Kong. So they have a very get tough kind of policy. In some ways, Hong Kong's a little bit similar to the U.S. in that sense, because on one hand, we have this policy of assisting victims of trafficking, but we also have a lot of concerns about the number of undocumented migrants. And a lot of people have a real anti-immigration point of view right now. And Hong Kong is similar to the U.S. in another respect in that it is actually a territory of immigrants. That's what's so ironic about it. Most of the people who live in Hong Kong came to Hong Kong from mainland China either after the revolution in 1949 or during the Cultural Revolution, or they're the descendants of people who were essentially refugees from mainland China. So they all have – most of them have connections to mainland China, and you would think that they might have a certain sympathy to migrants, but a lot of people don't. Hong Kong is a very densely populated place, and people are very concerned about too much immigration from mainland China, about being overwhelmed by mainland China. They're a special autonomous region. They're trying to maintain their autonomy and their separate identity. So there's understandably a bit of concern about that, but the result is that there's there's so much emphasis on arresting illegal migrants and punishing them and deterring them from coming back that I think they forget that a lot of these people have been duped or deceived or coerced, and they're not taking the time to investigate those cases.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Carol Peterson. She is professor of law at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, where she also serves as director of the Spark Matsunaga Institute for Peace. Before going to her teaching job there in Hawaii, she taught for a number of years at University of Hong Kong. And is here on the campus to give a talk on the subject Trafficking in Women, Legal Debates and Social Realities. This is the 19th annual Dan Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture, and that'll take place tomorrow night on the U of I campus. It's open to the public and free. Anyone who is interested should attend. And here on the program, questions are welcome as well. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm interested in maybe having you talk about another facet here, and I think it was actually something that you touched on, is that some of these international conventions that exist, what they do is they say that it's incumbent on countries to try to protect women who have been trafficked, to provide them assistance, to, if they wish, to help them to stay there, or if they wish, to help them to go home. Mm-hmm.
That's correct.
But at the same time, I think, as you said, that's something that's sort of suggested. It said it would be really nice if you would do this. It's not any kind of real serious requirement.
Yes, the trafficking protocol, and incidentally, it applies not just to women victims of trafficking, but to any victims of trafficking. It has very strong provisions on preventing trafficking. It's really more of a law enforcement treaty in many ways, but it is perhaps one of the first treaties in this field that does try to include a human rights perspective. But I would say that the human rights provisions are less mandatory in their terms than the criminal law enforcement provisions. And with any international law, enforcement is always an issue. I mean, international law is different from domestic law. You just can't take it into a court and wave it around. It's the law between states. And so the extent to which an international treaty is enforced depends very much on the enforcement mechanisms. Some treaties, you know, WTO has a very strong international enforcement mechanism. This treaty, it relies much more on pressure from other state parties. And the United States takes trafficking very seriously. And the State Department actually issues every year something called the TIP report, the Trafficking in Persons Report. And it essentially not only reports on trafficking in the U.S., but it also rates every country on their efforts to prevent and remedy trafficking. And they give every country a rating of anywhere from tier one for a country that fully meets its obligations, working its way down. So tier two is there are more concerns, and there's a tier two watch list. And I think quite a few countries do take this seriously. They want to receive a good rating. But I think it's even difficult for the U.S. government to know exactly what's going on in every country. I mean, for many years, Hong Kong received steadily every year a tier one rating because Hong Kong looks really good on the surface. I mean, we have a very independent legal profession, an independent judiciary. It's not corrupt. I mean, it's very different from mainland China. The laws seem to be good on paper. To be honest, it wasn't until we published our articles that Hong Kong's rating went down to tier two in 2009. I don't know if it was because of our articles, but I think it might have had something to do with it. I think that suddenly the U.S. government realized that it wasn't all what it seemed. But, you know, there are 137 state parties to the trafficking protocol. It's very difficult for any one government or even any international agency to assess what's happening on the ground in every country.
I took a look at the most current report, and I think that the State Department has been issuing these every year since 2000.
Roughly.
So I think that this is so that, and the most recent one is the one for 2009. So I did indeed take a look at this list, and it's really striking that while the ones that are on tier three, the worst category, there are about 20, I think, but then there are a whole bunch that are clustered in this group that says, well, they're trying, they're working on this, but that we, the United States Department of State, have some real concerns about this. And in that group, there are some very large countries, including Russia, China, India, Argentina, interestingly enough, a number of countries in Africa are in that tier two watch, but we have some concerns.
Sure.
So I'm not exactly sure what that means. I suppose it does come down to the question of what they're big countries. Obviously, they have a big problem. They have big borders, and whether that's just they're doing the best that they can given the scope of the problem.
I think that's often the case. Often, some of the countries that are on that watch list also have a real problem with corruption. China has a real problem with corruption. Mm-hmm. Hong Kong doesn't, to be honest. I think Hong Kong is very clean. But if a country has a problem with corrupt officials, it's very difficult to enforce anti-trafficking laws because there's a lot of money to be made. And the traffickers are willing to pay border guards and immigration officials and other people money to facilitate their business. So I think often the first thing for a government to do, if it can, and it's not easy, is to end corruption. And if they can do that, not only anti-trafficking laws, but all laws become easier to enforce. But that's a very serious problem in many, many countries. In Hong Kong, we have an LLM program, a master's in law program on international human rights. And we used to recruit students from all over Asia. Sometimes I'd have students from 15 different countries in my courses. And all of these students would always ask, where's the course on corruption? And I quickly realized that for many people in many countries, the most important human rights issue is corruption. And so we used to sometimes organize special lectures for them by the Independent Commission Against Corruption in Hong Kong, because that was, for them, the biggest issue. So I think if you looked at that report, you would find that many of the countries that have the worst ratings also get bad ratings for corruption generally.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that here on our line number one. Hello.
Right. You mentioned the amount of money. I've heard the figure that trafficking, and specifically in women for sex purposes, is up there with the illicit trafficking and drugs. So I don't know. That's probably hard to quantitize, too. Remember a story, I think war zones are particularly places where women are, and everyone are extremely vulnerable, and take it out is particularly important. And there was a pretty notorious case of a military contractor named Dyncor that was at a fairly high level caught trafficking in women out of the Balkans when they were doing whatever they were doing there. This is back in the mid-90s, I guess it would have been. So I just wanted you to mention something about that kind of vulnerability. But it also brings up the other dimension of trafficking, which I guess you're also looking at. I mean, I'm sure you're specifically looking at sex trafficking, but the U.S. itself was complicit. And again, it's this contractor business in a war zone where in Iraq, there are many stories of people being spirited to Iraq, thinking they were going somewhere else, and a very notorious case. So I think a Pulitzer Prize-winning story in the Chicago Tribune about a group of Nepalese who were thinking they were going somewhere in the Gulf and ended up in Iraq in the war zone. This was when it was much hotter in that region. So I know that's a lot of material, but I wonder if you could comment on those sort of basic three focuses, and I guess I'll hang up and listen on the air.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. Well, first of all, yes, I would agree with you. It's pretty impossible to reach a certain estimate of the amount of money that's involved. But I think the analogy to the drug industry is a good one, and that's also an area where we have very tough laws, but it's very difficult to enforce. And a lot of people think we're losing the war against drugs. War zones. Yes, that's always a special area of vulnerability, and I agree with you that private contractors, that's a real problem. Not only private contractors, though, to be honest, even UN peacekeeping troops have sometimes been found to be dealing in sex and to be buying sex from very young people who are very vulnerable in war zones. However, I wouldn't go so far as to say that war zones are the major source of trafficking. I mean, if you think about China, the women that we studied from mainland China, there's no war going on in southern China. What there is poverty and great income disparity. And I think that, as much as a war, makes people sometimes look across the border and look for other sources of income. The other thing I would like to point out is, although we've been talking mainly about sex trafficking so far, it is by no means the only field in which people are trafficked into. Some of the other research I've done is on migrant domestic workers. Lots of women leave countries like the Philippines and Indonesia, and they go to work as live-in housekeepers in places like Hong Kong, Malaysia, Singapore, the Middle East. Canada has a guest worker program. In one sense, I think sometimes these guest worker programs are a very good thing because they offer women a legal migration point. However, they have to be very carefully watched because these women can be very vulnerable to things like debt bondage. Very often they're recruited by private employment agencies in their countries who do not tell them about their legal rights and who take big placement fees from them. And although they're illegal, it turns out that when they get to a place like Hong Kong or Singapore, they're already in debt and they're in a situation of debt bondage where they may not get their salary for 3 to 5 months. So it's not just sex trafficking. Sex trafficking gets the most attention. But I don't think that the majority of people who are being trafficked around this world are trafficked into situations of sex trafficking. It's other areas of forced labor as well.
Yeah. Although I think it is striking, as I said in the beginning, and assuming that this is correct, that in fact, in overall, and we're talking about not just people who are being trafficked for sexual purposes, but also we could have situations like bonded labor where people end up in debt bondage, that more than – I was really struck by the fact that more than half – of all of these forced labor victims are women and girls, so more than half are female.
Mm-hmm. I think that is correct, yeah. Right? And I think that is the combined influence of the sex industry and the domestic servitude. Those two fields are very big. And then you add a certain amount of factory work as well.
Something that and I think in a sense you've answered the question, but I was interested in whether – it seems to be a problem that is trafficking, seems to be a problem that is growing. And I think that some people would say, well, yes, and it's tied, in fact, to poverty, as you say, and that in over the last year or something, particularly because of the global economic crisis that people have been living through, that has only just made it that much worse.
Yes, although I think the jury is still out on whether the economic recession is going to increase or decrease trafficking, because in one sense, yes, it increases poverty and more people might be vulnerable to trafficking. But I think it has also decreased the demand in some countries because some industries have compressed so much that they don't have the same demand for excess labor. There are fewer households in some countries that can afford domestic help, and so they're not seeking as many domestic helpers. And there are other industries that have compressed somewhat. So I think it's going to take some time to study whether or not the impact of this global recession is going to be increasing trafficking or not.
We have about 15 minutes, maybe a little bit more in this hour of focus. Our guest, Carol Peterson, she's practiced law in both New York and in Honolulu and Hong Kong. Where she taught at University of Hong Kong. She also served as director of the University of Hong Kong Center for Comparative and Public Law. She now teaches in Hawaii at University of Hawaii at Manoa at the law school there. She also serves as director of the Spark Matsunaga Institute for Peace. And she's here on the campus to spend a couple of days. She'll be giving a talk tomorrow night on the campus, 7:30. This is the 19th annual Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture, Trafficking in Women, Legal Debates and Social Realities. That's the title. Tomorrow night, 7:30, at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center on the campus on South Lincoln. It's open to the public. Anyone who is interested should feel welcome. I'll see her on the program. Questions, comments, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that the international conventions, agreements having to do with trafficking, it at least suggest that countries have some responsibility to the women that end up victims of trafficking within their borders. One of the things I think we know is that if women who have been victims of trafficking if they manage to get back home, can face real serious problems back at home in reintegrating into their own country and their own society, maybe their own town, their own family.
That's correct.
Is there any attempt in addressing the problem of trafficking to say something to governments about any sort of responsibility they might have for women who have been victims of trafficking who manage to actually get home?
There should be. The trafficking protocol does urge governments to provide reintegration and rehabilitation services. I think in practice very often not much is done at all. Mm-hmm. And victims of trafficking face a double fear. One is the stigma, especially if you've been trafficked into the sex industry, is very strong. And that's why a lot of women actually are trafficked under false names. They're given visas in another person's name. And sometimes the trafficker will say, this is to protect your reputation. It actually makes them more vulnerable, though, legally, because then now you're making a false statement to the immigration officers when you travel under a fake visa. But that's one of the reasons that sometimes traffickers persuade women and girls that they should travel under a completely fake name. The other thing that these women face is that if they're arrested or located by the authorities, and if they are repatriated, if they're not given residency rights in the country where they are arrested, if they're repatriated, they may find themselves under the influence of the traffickers again when they're returned, because sometimes they still owe money. So remember, a lot of these people, they come to the country under an agreement that they will later repay the traffickers for their visa and transportation costs out of their earnings. And if they are located by the immigration authorities before they repay that debt, then when they go home, they're still in a situation of debt bondage. And so the traffickers or their associates may visit them in their hometown and either try to get them to be trafficked again or seek repayment. And we did interview at least two women in the Hong Kong prisons who had been in a situation like that, that they had come to Hong Kong and actually were arrested very quickly. And then when they went back to their hometown, they were visited by the same woman who had recruited them originally and said, now you have to come back again because you still haven't paid me. So we classified them as a victim of repeat trafficking because twice they had been coerced. And they were very young. They were 16, 17 years old. So going back home is very difficult. And most governments will say that they have some programs for assisting victims. But again, the implementation in practice is very patchy, mm-hmm. I would say. Mm-hmm.
How do you think that enforcement could be improved, that this issue could be better addressed? I'm sure that it's very complicated, particularly in a lot of places where, as you say, whatever they have for law enforcement is really overwhelmed. Maybe they have a real issue with people who are coming to the country illegally for all sorts of reasons.
Well, I think in some countries it would be nice if we had more undercover operations designed to find the traffickers rather than simply to arrest the trafficked persons. Certainly I felt that way in Hong Kong. There were a lot of raids, a lot of undercover police officers, but they seemed to prosecute the women. And maybe it's just because it's easier for them to get the evidence against the women. And sometimes it's hard to get people to testify against the managers and the traffickers and the mama-sons. But I think that would be a step in the right direction. Even in the United States, if you read that 2009 report, there weren't that many cases of trafficking that were actually prosecuted. And there are some very big, notorious prosecutions where, you know, a number of people go to jail. But I think the chances of being caught as a trafficker are still very low. And so there's not much incentive, really, for a trafficker to find another way of making a living. I'm not a law enforcement expert, though, and I hesitate to offer too many views on that, because even if you look at the analogy, the war against drugs, I mean, I've read many articles by former police officers in the war against drugs, and they often say that every time I arrested a drug trafficker, I just felt like I was creating an employment opportunity on the streets for the next one who would take his place. So the problem is some of these industries are just so profitable that it's a very attractive business for people. And I am increasingly looking at, you know, ways of legalizing certain businesses. I often think that we would be better off if we decriminalized drug use, because I think we might have a better chance of removing the criminal elements, or at least keeping it under control. And this is, of course, a very hot debate in feminists on the sex industry. I mean, in the United States, with the exception of Nevada, it's basically illegal, but it seems, you know, we don't seem to do a very good job of eradicating it. Some countries, such as Sweden, have adopted a model where the buying of sex is criminalized, but not the selling of sex. They treat women in prostitution as victims, and they really try to prosecute the buyers and the pimps. And a lot of feminists who believe in eradicating prostitution believe that that's the model that should be followed. But other people feel that we should go the other way. If you look at Australia, Germany, the Netherlands, they've completely legalized prostitution. And the idea of legalizing the sex industry is that you try to regulate it in a way. You do inspections to make sure that people are not being mistreated, to make sure that minors are not involved and that there's no coercion. And some people think that that's really the way to go, and that you can try to reduce the dependency of sex workers on the criminal gangs. Other people are very offended by that because, of course, what it means is that the state is essentially putting its stamp of approval on the selling of sex, and many people really just can't stomach that. But I think that we need to look at avenues like that. I think we need to consider whether our current law enforcement approach to things like the sex industry is working, and whether it isn't just victimizing people more.
I have an email here, and I'll just read it. The person who's listening writes that apparently that ABC News recently did an expose of fishing tours, quote unquote, that included underage women organized from Texas and sold at fish and game conventions. That seems the kind of activity condoned by the United States. Now, this is what the listener writes, and this story is new to me. I don't know.
One to me. I can assure you the United States government would not condone it. The United States government may not have been aware of it, may not have done a good job of preventing it, but I can't imagine that we would have condoned it. But it's a new story to me.
All right. Well, other questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Trafficking does happen in the United States?
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. Not only trafficking across borders, but there is something called internal trafficking. Some countries don't view it as trafficking if you don't cross an immigration border, but I think the United States recognizes it as trafficking. It's not uncommon for a young teenage girl to be lured into the sex industry, say, in New York and brought to L.A. or some other city. And again, it's the same strategy by the trafficker, because you're removing someone from their home environment where they're making them feel more vulnerable. Quite often, girls are lured into the industry by someone who will pretend to be their boyfriend initially. And then sometimes they'll be told that the boyfriend is in debt, that he needs assistance in getting out of debt. Would she help him by, you know, doing some sex work? Quite often they're introduced to illegal drugs and they develop a drug habit that destroys their sense of self. I mean, it's very sad what happens. And there is quite a lot of research to show that a large number of women who are in the sex industry in the U.S., and I'm talking about American women now, were recruited into the sex industry when they were underage, and that they were often introduced to drugs and alcohol as a way of kind of numbing their feelings. And that is probably the strongest argument against legalization of the sex industry, because there is a great fear that even if you tried to regulate it and you tried to remove coercion, you wouldn't be able to do so, and that the people who would be lured into it are the people who are not really in a position to make an informed decision and really give informed consent to sex work.
And I suppose there are also people who make this argument that that no woman ever truly could give informed consent to sex work.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, there's a whole movement of the feminist movement. Some people refer to it as the radical feminists or the abolitionists, who believe that it is impossible for a woman to give informed consent, and that the women who purport to have consented to sex work really have done so because they've kind of lost their sense of self, either through drug use or just through the trauma of sex work. Mm-hmm. There is a fair amount of research by psychologists that shows that a lot of women in the sex industry were actually victims of sexual abuse as children, and that this sort of set them up for being more vulnerable to being brought into the sex industry. But I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, so I can't really offer an expert opinion on that. But just so you realize, that is part of the debate on whether or not women can give informed consent. On the other hand, there are many very well-organized sex worker advocacy groups around the world filled with women who claim that they have given informed consent and that this is their chosen profession and they believe they should be allowed to practice it without harassment, either by law enforcement or by pimps.
When you were in Hong Kong and you did this study that we're talking about, was there something in particular, I suppose, that would be a natural extension of the areas that you're interested in for your research? Was there something in particular that drew you into looking at that?
Well, I've always been interested in women's rights. And when I first moved to Hong Kong in 1989, there was virtually no law on women's rights in Hong Kong. We didn't even have a sex discrimination law. So you could see ads in the newspaper advertising for male accountants and female secretaries. I mean, it was very blatant. So I got interested in the women's movement to begin with, and I did some work on law reform there. And then at a certain point in time, I became very interested in the migrant women in Hong Kong because it's almost like two classes of people. I mean, Hong Kong has a very vibrant economy, really. I mean, there are people who are poor, but in general, there's a lot of opportunity in Hong Kong. And then you would see this large group. Sometimes, I mean, there's probably more than 200,000 migrant domestic workers who work in Hong Kong. And then there was this increasingly large group of mainland sex workers who are increasingly populating the prisons of Hong Kong. And one of the things that my colleagues and I found so interesting is that it used to be before the year 2000 or before 1997 when Hong Kong returned to Chinese sovereignty, it was fairly hard for someone from mainland China to get a visa to come to Hong Kong. And so most of the sex workers in Hong Kong were, in fact, from Hong Kong. And as I said before, sex work for them is not illegal. There are a lot of restrictions. You can't solicit. You can't form a brothel. But if you practice as an independent sex worker, what we call a one-woman brothel in Hong Kong, it's legal. And then after 1997, it became easier for people from mainland China to get visas to come to Hong Kong. And all of a sudden, all the research on the sex industry was saying that it was becoming predominantly mainland Chinese women. And all these women were being arrested and imprisoned in Hong Kong for offenses related to sex work. What we found interesting at the law school is that there was virtually no increase in the number of people that the Hong Kong government was classifying as victims of trafficking. And it seemed absurd. I mean, you go from a point where there are almost no mainland sex workers being arrested. Now there are thousands. I mean, one year there was almost 10,000 of them admitted to prison in Hong Kong, and yet just a handful who were victims of trafficking. So that's where we got the idea. That's what drew us to it. We wanted to find out why is it nobody's a victim of trafficking. So I have to hand it to the Hong Kong government. They were very nice. I mean, we not only got a grant to do the research, but we also got permission from the Correctional Services Department to go into the prisons and do these interviews. And we hired an interpreter because most of these women don't speak Cantonese, which is the local dialect in Hong Kong. They speak Mandarin or some other Chinese dialect. And we did very detailed interviews, and it was fascinating to see how this subterranean economy was working. There had been previous studies of sex workers in Hong Kong, but they tended to focus on women who were working more openly on the streets, local Hong Kong women. And they were not locating the women who were working under third-party management. Because, of course, you can't just waltz into a brothel and say, I want to interview your sex workers, right? So accessing the women in prison was a way to access women who had worked under third-party management. And I think our study is probably the first one that did that in Hong Kong. And I found it very interesting, the results. I'm hoping that the Hong Kong government will take our results seriously and maybe do more to investigate the individual circumstances of women, particularly the very young teenagers, because I think that's where most of the trafficking occurs, the young teenagers.
I guess it comes back to this point. I wondered, you know, to what extent one of the issues here is that governments are looking at women who have been trafficked, and they're regarding them as essentially being illegal immigrants.
That's correct.
And not really considering the circumstances under which they got there. So they're looking at them as being illegal immigrants and then concentrating their prosecution efforts on them rather than to the extent that they could and should, the people who brought them there in the first place.
I think there's a little bit of that. I mean, to be fair, I think a lot of governments will prosecute traffickers if they find them, but it's harder to find them. The traffickers are very good at, you know, disappearing when the police officers come. But I also think what it really demonstrates is the truth is it's not that easy to draw a line. And that's why I titled the lecture tomorrow, Legal Debates and Social Realities. The legal debate is, what's the definition of trafficking and how do we classify this person as a victim of trafficking or an illegal migrant? And they do it as if it's easy to draw that firm line between the two. But what I think the social research shows is that people start out on one side, they go to the other side, and for them, there is no clear line, right? That's a line that we made up in the legal system. For most people, there's not that much difference often between someone who gets lucky and is classified as a victim of trafficking and someone who's unlucky and is prosecuted as an illegal migrant. Very often, their circumstances are quite similar, and they can change over time. So that's what I think we need to look at is how do we develop a compassionate policy for dealing with someone who is not completely the virtuous victim of trafficking. They were not abducted, right, and dragged across the line. They did participate somewhat in the process that led to them being trafficked. But how do we deal with them in a compassionate way that fits the social reality?
And I'm sorry, I wonder whether if a woman was a victim of trafficking and she's arrested, but what she's charged with is an immigration offense, and then maybe spends some time in jail and maybe ultimately is deported, is that really – and then you compare that with someone who maybe is acknowledged to be a victim of trafficking, but that there's really not very much that country is willing or able to do. One wonders, is there really very much difference in the ultimate outcome in either of those cases?
I see. Well, it depends on the country. In the United States, huge difference, because we do have a victims assistance program, and there are people who have obtained T visas. Not only for themselves, but sometimes for their families. They've actually been able to bring their families here. It doesn't always happen. But I think being designated as a victim of trafficking makes a big difference in the United States and in some other countries. Not everywhere, though. You're correct.
Well, that we'll have to stop here for this hour of Focus. But we do want to make sure that people who are listening know that our guest for the program, Carol Peterson from University of Hawaii, she's here on the campus for a couple of days. And we'll be speaking tomorrow night on the campus at 7:30, talking about trafficking in women, legal debates, and social realities. This is the 19th annual Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture. It's named for Dan Sanders, who was for many years a dean of the School of Social Work at the U of I. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.